keeps getting bigger. And then, at school today, the static electricity from the other kids just made it angry. June tugged on Margot's shirt.
Well, afraid it's gonna stop sucking people in, like the blob.
Hazel made an indignant noise, but moved behind her father out of sight. Margot turned to Kyle, brows lifted.
I should not have let them watch that vintage horror movie marathon, he admitted.
Margot sighed. She felt deeply underqualified to handle this. But Hazel looked so miserable with her giant cloud of hair. And she just couldn't let Kyle make this worse for his daughter before she went back to school. Hazel was already the principal's kid, which probably made life at school hard enough. This is not a problem that can be solved with more shampoo, Margot told him, leading the little family back into the shampoo and conditioner aisle. June climbed down from her father's arms and tugged on Margot's jean pocket as she walked. Margot carefully peeled her hand away and tucked it back into Kyle's. It was unsettling how quickly kids attached themselves to people they barely knew. She needed to help poor Hazel with her follicle emergency and then get away from Kyle and his kids and his soft, teasing lips as quickly as possible. Surely there had to be some nice local lady who could decipher Kyle's dual personality and his girl's personal hygiene issues. She just needed to make some sort of dignified exit and never leave work or home again, so these awkward encounters would stop. Reasonable solution. Margot searched for the best brand among the value labels and started handing Kyle products. Deep conditioning, spray detangler, and a wet brush. And if that doesn't work... Margot turned to Kyle with a hesitant expression on her face.
I'm scared, Kyle whispered.
Do you have olive oil at home? Margot separated from the little family as soon as Hazel's hair care regimen was selected. She didn't even say goodbye. She just said, All right, then. Good luck. And disappeared like fog. She felt a little guilty being rude to children. But this breakdown of the sexy, brooding image she'd had of Kyle to the responsible school administrator to the guy picking out no-tear shampoo was too much for her to handle. Not because it destroyed her unreasonable expectations, but because she could picture that very easily. Kyle standing at the stove while the girls ran around the kitchen waving their sticky hands near all the available surfaces. She shook that image out of her head. As adorable as Kyle's baggage might have been, she was in no way prepared to deal with them. All she'd wanted was a nice, simple romp with the hot, broody local. She didn't want to know about his home life. She didn't want to meet his adorable, follically challenged children. The lump of unease in her belly turned to ice-cold disappointment as she grasped the full implications of Kyle having kids. It felt like a death of possibilities. She was not prepared for this kind of complication in her life. She was going to be leaving Lake Sackett in a few weeks, God willing. She did not have time to form any sort of attachment to a single father of two girls. Unfortunately, that father of two girls managed to catch up to her as she was loading her groceries into the truck. Over his shoulder, she could see that June was already strapped into the booster seat inside. What she realized now was a sensible, family-friendly four-door truck. Hazel was climbing in after her. Margot moved toward the driver's side door, but couldn't unlock it without being obvious about dodging him.
Hey, I didn't have a chance to say thank you properly, he said. I really appreciate the help. Every time I think I have a handle on this whole parenting daughters thing, something pops up and bites me on my ass. And Hazel struggles without her mom.
As someone with challenging hair, I sympathize with her plight, Margot said. Kyle cleared his throat.
So, this is...
uncomfortable to the point of pain?
I was going to go with a little awkward and end it there,
Kyle countered, pursing his lips.
There was a pause in the conversation. With the way Kyle was looking her over, his gaze appreciative, Margot thought that he might ask her out. And she was already coming up with a list of reasons why she couldn't accept. But she didn't have the opportunity to use any of them because he just smiled and said, "Well, I'll see you around," and pushed his empty cart toward the corral. Margot couldn't help but fight back some discontent. Clearly, the connection she'd felt with him in that brief moment of madness hadn't meant nearly as much to him as it had to her. And that was a good thing, right? She didn't need to get all tangled up with this man and his kids. It was already going to be messy enough leaving her own family behind in Lake Sackett. Margot palmed her keys. Right. Good life choices. Minimal complications. She yanked open her door and called over her shoulder, "So, if you see me sometime in the next 24 hours, it's not stalking. It's a coincidence. An embarrassing and ill-timed coincidence." Kyle opened his driver's side door and smirked.
"That's what the last girl who stalked me said."
After the missed lunch debacle, Margot had planned to avoid her father. Stan had made his priorities clear. She needed to do the same. She just wanted to do her work, stay away from charming single fathers, then find a job and get out of town before she had to deal with Stan again. She got really good at tailoring her schedule to avoid seeing him at work, orbiting around the funeral home on a Stan-free track. Of course, her scruffy cousin blew that plan all to hell at the earliest possible opportunity just a few days later. Duffy insisted on showing her the other side of the business by taking her fishing. She pictured waking up around 9, going to the Rise and Shine, and then spending an hour flicking some bait over the water just to say they did it. She did not expect him to show up at her cabin before dawn, throw some worn boots at her, and drag her into his truck. In most cases, being dragged from bed into anyone's truck would be problematic. "I'm reporting this as a kidnapping as soon as I'm awake," she said through a yawn, leaning her forehead against his cool passenger window. "I have memorized the number for the Georgia State Patrol."
"You'll never get a cell signal out here," he reminded her.
"I'll mail them a letter," she countered, her face smashed against the glass. "On very official-looking paper." But when she woke up, she didn't have time or stationery with which to report her cousin for multiple felonies, because she was sitting on a bench against the weathered red exterior of the snack shack. The water lapped loudly against the dock, occasionally splashing hard enough that droplets launched up from the surface and landed near her feet. She started, shrieking a little bit, grateful that she hadn't rolled off the bench and into the water. "Duffy! Did you carry me down the dock while I was asleep? That is wrong." But Duffy didn't answer. She couldn't even see him, only the peachy orange of sunrise peeking over the horizon. The water lapped gently under the dock, its glittering surface making Margot squint even behind her sunglasses. Margot groaned and rubbed her hand over her face. "I'm going to shave his head while he sleeps." "Here, hon. This will perk you right up." Margot jerked again. Her eyes flew open, and she found the tiny form of Bob's wife, Leslie, blocking the rising sun. "Aunt Leslie? What are you doing here so early? Did Duffy kidnap you, too?" A compact pixie with fading blonde hair and a penchant for floppy straw hats, Leslie passed her an enormous thermal mug. "You have to wake up pretty early to beat the fishermen to the water, and I have to have the food ready for them. Now you take a big swig of that. Bob told me the brew was hard on your system, so I mixed in some milk and sugar, like we fix for the kids." Margot rolled the oversweet substance on her tongue and winced. "You give this to children?" "Well, not Nate," Les said, shaking her head. She pressed a grease-spotted paper bag into Margot's hands.
I've got to get to work.
Here, hon. You tell Duffy I made these for your breakfast.
Margot sniffed the bag. It smelled like at least 2 hours on an elliptical.
What is it?
Bacon, wrapped around a sausage, stuffed with cheese, dipped in egg batter and deep fried. I call it a breakfast stick.
I don't know how to respond to that.
The gravy's in the spare thermos,
Les called brightly, walking back into the shack. Margot heard a rumbling and turned to see Duffy guiding what looked like a floating front porch toward her. According to the bright red paint scrawled across the bow, it was called Sarah Jane. He waved cheerfully.
Hello, the dock.
Hello, wide flat boat thing, she called back.
This is a pontoon boat,
he told her, as he deftly steered it parallel to the dock without colliding with it.
I figured it would be a little bit more your speed than one of our bass rigs.
You would be correct, she said, as he helped her step on board. She was pleased that the boat didn't give under her feet. It had a nice, stable surface, not at all tippy.
Here, Aunt Leslie gave us breakfast.
Duffy looked into the bag and grinned. He called over Margot's shoulder.
Oh, hey, Les. We're gonna need enough for two more.
Is Frankie coming with us?
Margot asked, stowing her purse under one of the seat cushions and flopping onto the wide couch-like seats.
Not exactly,
Duffy said, flushing beneath his gingery beard.
Duffy, what did you do?
Margot turned to follow his eyeline and saw her father walking on the dock with Aunt Donna at his side. Aunt Donna looked ready for camping in the outback, wearing a khaki tank top with a green bandana knotted around her neck. Her frizzled reddish hair blew in a curly cloud around her face, occasionally falling over a pair of black aviator sunglasses. She was sunburnished and blousy, but looked perfectly at ease as she jumped onto the boat. Seeing the uncomfortable expression on Margot's face, Stan dropped the large Coleman cooler gently to the dock. A chubby Jack Russell Terrier with gray-white hairs streaking out from its muzzle trotted down the dock, wearing a little doggy life vest. Huffing at Stan until he stepped aside, the dog leaped gracefully onto the boat and hopped up on the seat nearest Donna. It turned in a circle until it found the best napping in the sunshine position and dropped to its stomach.
Look, I can just stay here, Stan said,
as Donna tossed a bag full of gear to her son.
Don't feel much like fishing anyway.
No, no, you stay. I'll go, Margot said, grabbing at the cushion that hid her bag. You'll probably get more out of this trip than I would.
No, the whole point of going out this morning was to teach you about fishing,
Stan protested, as Leslie dropped a grease-spotted bag into Duffy's waiting hands.
And I don't want to mess that.
Really, it's no trouble. I'll just head back to the cabin and catch up on chores.
Now listen here. If your cousin wants to take you fishing, I'm not going to interfere.
Donna turned, hands on hips.
Get your ass on the boat, Stan.
But...
Donna lowered her sunglasses and glared at Stan. He threw his arms into the air.
Fine.
While Margot sat, feeling pretty useless, the other three moved about the boat with practiced ease, securing the canvas screen overhead, prepping fishing rods, and, most important, distributing the breakfast sticks. The terrier popped its head up, sniffing with hopeful eyes, but Donna scratched behind its ears and dug a treat out of her fishing vest.
No breakfast sticks for you, Willie,
she said, though Margot noted her no-nonsense aunt didn't have a cutesy dog voice. Her dog voice was just as exasperated as her people voice.
I'm not going to have the vet fussing at me over your cholesterol again. Willie's been fishing with Mom and her charters for more than 10 years,
Duffy told her.
He's enjoyed a fair share of breakfast sticks in his lifetime.
Do the charter clients mind sharing their boat with a dog? Margot asked.
Anybody who does mine gets tossed off my boat, Donna said, peering over her aviators at her niece.
Margot raised her hands in surrender.
Understood. Duffy revved the engine while Stan cast off a line.
Margot just sat there and smeared SPF 30 sunscreen on her face and throat.
Leslie stuck her head out of the snack shack and waved them off with a big grin on her face. Behind her, trucks were already pulling into the marina lot, eager for coffee and bait and deep-fried breakfast.
Here you go.
Donna plopped a floppy canvas fisherman's hat on top of Margot's head.
You're gonna need more than sunscreen to protect that fair skin of yours, big city.
Actually, I've always tanned pretty easily, Margot said. I just haven't been outdoors much lately, so I'm kind of fish-belly pale. Donna scoffed.
Stan's the same way. Get him near a strong light bulb and he's brown as a walnut.
Margot glanced at her father's craggy face. He nodded and shrugged, seeming pleased that Donna had noted a similarity between him and his daughter. Margot cleared her throat.
So, where are you taking me?
One of my favorite spots, Donna assured her, as Duffy glided the boat easily across the water.
Crappie galore. You'll love it.
Donna handed her one of the rods she'd brought, with the MacCready Family Funeral Home and Bait Shop logo printed on the reel. She explained the mechanics of casting, when to release the tab on the reel, how to know when to start turning the spinning handle, and then dropped it into Margot's palms.
Trust me, any fool can use this.
Margot grimaced. She had a feeling Donna would have no problem telling her when she was being a fool. Donna slapped a plastic container of minnows on the seat next to her.
If you want to fish on my boat, you're gonna have to bait your own hook. Put that college education of yours to good use.
Margot lifted the lid of the minnow container and blanched at the poor, defenseless feeder fish. Oddly enough, fish murder wasn't covered in my major. Margot was well aware of her own disgusted expression as she struggled to slip the hook through the bait. She didn't even look up as she felt her father's weight settle next to her.
Don't you know anything about baiting a hook?
Stan asked, glancing up to make sure Donna wasn't watching while he demonstrated the proper skewering technique.
Well, I didn't spend a lot of time fishing as a kid.
Or any time, really, she said, subtly shifting away from him on the seat. At least she hoped it was subtle.
Well, what did you do?
Margot stared at him. After the lunch debacle, he didn't deserve to know anything about her childhood. She wasn't going to answer. But then Donna started giving her the scary, pointed glare. And Margot said, piano, which I was terrible at, ballet, at which I was a bit better, French lessons, horseback riding, though I never got to a competition level beyond our country club.
It figures you'd have that sort of thing up there in Chicago.
I was lucky. Gerald wanted to make sure I had all the same extracurricular opportunities as my classmates.
Was that your mom's husband?
Margot nodded. They married when I was still very young.
Was he good to you?
Stan asked.
This Gerald? Was he decent to you?
He's a very decent man. A doctor. He's in England right now, doing a teaching fellowship at a medical school there. We haven't spoken in a long time, but when we do, it's very civil.
Well, at least there's that, Stan said.
Margot swallowed. Suddenly uncomfortable. She didn't want to compare and contrast father figures. She didn't appreciate Duffy's meddling. She didn't appreciate being trapped on a boat with her estranged father. Surely this was some sort of scenario designed by Alfred Hitchcock. Maybe she could swim to shore. She tried to focus on the passing scenery. She didn't know much about lakes, despite growing up near one of the largest in the world. But she recognized signs of drought when she saw them. The shore was marked by at least 2 feet of baked earth. Mud-coated trash lay exposed in the shallows.
It was like seeing a body of water without its toupee. Sad and lesser and sort of desperate.
"Shouldn't you have a tour booked this morning?" she asked Duffy over the noise of the engine.
Duffy flushed again, glancing at his mom.
"Yeah, well, the doctor I had booked backed out at the last minute."
"Duff, it wasn't your fault."
Aunt Donna's voice softened for the first time since Margot had arrived in Lake Sackett.
"The doctor canceled his whole weekend when he saw the cabin he booked. That idiot Maybelline Mathis has been renting out the potting shed behind her house and calling it a guest cabin. She puts fake pictures on the rental website. It was bound to catch up with her eventually."
"It's been happening a lot," Duffy grumped. "It's the fourth cancellation I've had in the last couple of weeks. People are losing their patience with the town. The water's too low, and the rental cabins are getting shabby, and the owners can't afford to fix them up again because the renters cancel. I don't know how much longer we're going to be able to keep this up."
"Well, that's a real cheerful sentiment for this early in the morning, son,"
Donna retorted, her flinty tone restored.
"Moaning over a looming financial disaster is just what I wanted as a side for my breakfast stick."
Duffy jerked his shoulders as he slowed the boat and anchored it about 20 yards from the shore of a little alcove surrounded by fallen trees. Stan was largely unaffected by this exchange, his big basset hound eyes focused on his daughter.
"And your mama? Was she finally happy in the big city?"
"What do you mean by that?" Margot asked, standing on steady legs and moving to the starboard side of the boat. Watching Duffy's and Donna's movements, she plopped her minnowed hook into the water.
"I mean, she was never happy here. I just want to know, was she finally happy, moving to a big city, marrying a doctor, being away from this place? Was she happy?"
Margot frowned. Her mother hadn't been built for happiness. Surely, having been married to her, Stan knew that. Resentment rose up in her throat, hot and bitter. She noticed her father hadn't mentioned his drinking this time. What was Stan looking for? Did he want her to take away his guilt? Was she supposed to convince him he'd done the right thing by doing nothing to get Margot back? What gave him the right to ask these things?
"Margot?"
Stan said, following her to the side of the boat. Margot stared across the water, determined to ignore him. In the distance, she saw the silhouette of a beautiful wooden sailboat, the old-fashioned kind you saw in aftershave commercials. It slipped smoothly across the water, and Margot was struck with a sort of envious longing. Stan was still standing next to her, asking her questions, but she managed to block him out, focusing on the distant ship. What would it be like to move so quickly and quietly? She'd known plenty of people with yachts on Lake Michigan, but they'd been more mini cruise ships, used for parties and not much else. This boat looked like it was flying. She longed to stand on that deck and slide so easily into the wind. But then again, any place seemed preferable to where she was standing, being interrogated by her father. The sailboat veered closer, and suddenly Margot pulled her fishing hat over her face and slumped down. Kyle Archer, windblown and handsome, was sitting at the rudder, and wearing a life vest that should have made him as dumpy as she felt in her floppy hat and flotation device. But it didn't. He was gorgeous, damn it. And he was smiling, his face angled down as he talked to someone slumped against the hull. A long brown ponytail flapped in the breeze over the edge of the highly polished wood. Her first thought was, girlfriend. And she was surprised by the spike of jealousy that flared in her belly. She didn't get jealous. A man proved himself unworthy or unavailable, she moved on. But the idea of Kyle sailing around with that happy expression on his face because of another woman, it made... The brunette head popped over the hull,
and Margot saw that it was his daughter, Hazel, she of the challenged follicles. Somehow, that was worse. This was a man with a family. His attention would always be divided. He would never have time for spontaneous moments together, because he would have to deal with babysitters and pick-up schedules. His daughters would always come first, as they should. She didn't think she would want him as much as she did if he put them second. A little puttering motor in the distance drew Margot's attention away from the sailboat and its baffling owner. She was struck by the image of an African-American man in his 50s aiming for their boat at what seemed to be ramming speed. He wore a Braves cap that looked like he'd had it since boyhood, but his boat looked showroom new. As he drew closer, Margot recognized him as the man Donna had been yelling at on the dock days before. He turned the boat just as he killed the engine, meaning he splashed their pontoon as he skidded to a drifting halt.
"Donna McCready," he yelled. "I know you're not poaching my territory."
"I don't see your name on it, Fred Dodge," she yelled back.
Margot was grateful for the interruption of her less loud but more awkward conversation. She would much rather watch her Aunt Donna yell at someone who was not her. Stan and Duffy seemed more exasperated than worried by the exchange, sitting back on the cushions of the pontoon and crossing their arms. So Margot sat back too, in a spot as far away from Stan as possible, to enjoy the show as Fred yelped,
"Woman, you know I've been fishing that spot since we were in high school."
Margot watched the verbal fencing between her aunt and Mr. Dodge with a little smile on her lips. She couldn't help but notice the way Donna's face flushed as she parried and shouted. Mr. Dodge's wide brown eyes blazed as he wagged his finger at her aunt. They were into each other. In a big way.
"She's right," Duffy said dryly. "I signed the territory agreement as a witness. Your exclusive spot is over on Deer Tick Bay."
Fred pursed his lips.
"Oh, right. Well, that doesn't change the fact that you're in my spot here, Donna."
"Fine," Donna bit out. She stomped over and started the motor, then moved the boat 10 yards down the shore. "Happy now?"
"Overjoyed,"
Fred shouted back. He started his engine and guided his boat away, but he glanced over his shoulder to see if Donna was watching. Margot grinned. Fred had it bad for Donna. Scary, loud Donna. They would be the most prickly, adorable couple if they ever stopped yelling at each other. Triumphant and clinging to her favorite fishing spot, Donna dropped her hook in the water and stretched across her seat, long legs propped on the bow. Stan had turned his back on everybody and commenced fishing. Duffy occupied himself with eating his breakfast stick. Margot watched her bobber, well, bobbing, for almost an hour, with no change. And she realized that she'd missed very little, not going on fishing trips as a child. It was hot, and too sunny, and too quiet, and everything smelled like dirt and pennies and frustration. And she'd forgotten her cell phone on her nightstand when Duffy abducted her, so this was basically her nightmare. Margot huffed out a breath and pulled her hat over her face, hoping it would muffle her frustrated groan.
"What are you doing, girl?"
She pulled her hat back to see Stan staring at her, his brow furrowed. She cleared her throat.
Nothing. Just trying to keep the sun out of my eyes."
"Well, that's no way to do it."
Stan set his root beer aside and reached up to shape the brim over her face. He tapped her nose with his index finger.
"And you should put some zinc on that nose before you get burnt. You couldn't stand having a sunburn when you were little. Used to carry a jar of Noxzema around the house, telling everybody you were dying."
Margot glanced up into her father's face. He was gazing down at her, a little smile playing on his lips as he relived this memory.
Out of the corner of her eyes, she saw the sailboat pass. She dipped her head down to avoid eye contact, and Stan's hands froze, millimeters from her cheeks.
"Sorry,"
he mumbled, and shuffled away to the other side of the boat. And that tension that had been building up inside Margot snapped.
"Look, I don't know what you want from me. You had a chance to get to know me, and you left me hanging. How am I supposed to trust you enough to try now? These memories that you have of me that you keep bringing up? I don't remember anything like that. And you asking me all of these questions, it's not going to make me remember. And I can't change it. It is what it is. I can't tiptoe around your feelings because I have no idea what happened between you and my mother. And it's not my job to make you feel better about it either way."
"Well, what am I supposed to think?" he demanded. "Your mama ran off without a word. I don't hear from you for years. Tens of years. And then you show up out of the blue after all this time and I'm supposed to what? Say, thank you for deciding to show up? I didn't expect to see you again. And you don't get why I would be too intimidated to just go to lunch with you the other day?"
"Oh, I have a lot of things to say to you on the subject of showing up, if you'd like to start a dialogue," she said, smiling with so much acid it could dissolve the bottom of the boat.
"See, that's why I can't even have a conversation with you. You talk like a damn robot."
"Don't curse at me," she shot back. He crossed his arms over his chest, eyes narrowed.
"Yep, there's your mama in you,"
Margot yelled.
"You do not talk about my mother.
Don't tell me what I can and can't say. I'm your father."
"You haven't done anything to deserve the title of father. You might as well have been a sperm donor for all I knew from you."
For a moment, Margot didn't know whether Stan was going to slap her or burst into tears. Having been raised by two passive-aggressive cold fish, she couldn't remember seeing such strong emotions fighting it out on a person's face. No one in the family had ever mentioned Stan having a nasty temper, even when he drank. But had she pushed him so far that he would lash out like that? Was it sick that she wanted to know? Maybe she was just some giant psychological cliche, pushing at her parents' boundaries to see what she could get away with. Therapy would probably be a good idea. Once she was living outside of the Lake Sackett gossip zone. Stan glanced down at his clenched hands and seemed horrified, backing away from her and putting several feet of space between them. A tiny flicker of guilt fluttered to life inside her, and she told herself it was natural to feel bad about making anyone hurt that much. It had nothing to do with who Stan was or any feelings she had about him. Not wanting to hurt another human being only proved Margot wasn't a complete sociopath.
"Well, this is fun,"
Donna spat, making a sour face at Duffy.
"Take 'em fishing, you said. Put 'em on a boat where they can't get away from each other, you said. They'll have to bond eventually, you said."
Duffy threw his hands up in the air in a helpless gesture. Stan crossed the boat, sitting as far away from Margot as possible. The baleful silence between them lasted for hours, until Donna and Duffy caught their fill. Stan was clearly off his game, catching only a handful. Margot, predictably, caught nothing. Seriously, why did people put themselves through this and call it a hobby? Why were there so many movies, books, magazines, TV shows dedicated to sitting still and staring at water? She resorted to making lists in her head to keep herself sane. Groceries she needed to shop for, contacts she still needed to make in her job search, excuses to give to Duffy so she never had to go fishing again. She almost wept with relief when her cousin yanked the anchor from the mucky bottom and motored the pontoon boat back toward the family marina. Stan kept his back to her up until the moment the boat bumped against the dock. And frankly, that was the only bright spot to her morning.
"Well, that was fun,"
Donna said dryly, as Stan moved with more speed than anyone could have expected from him and leaped onto the dock. He stormed toward the parking lot without a word, gear in hand.
Damn fool.
Aunt Donna, thank you for taking me fishing, Margot said politely, as Duffy helped her step off the boat. She whirled on her cousin and pointed a finger in Duffy's face.
You. Dead to me.
Duffy poked his bottom lip out in a pout so pathetic she added,
For at least 2 days.
The pout turned into a smile, so she felt compelled to smack the back of his fluffy head and snatch the truck key from the carabiner that secured it to his fishing vest. And you're riding home with your mother.
I deserve that,
Duffy conceded. Chapter 8 Margot bobbled the plastic storage containers as she knocked on the door of the main house. The biggest and oldest of the cabins on the compound, Tootie and EJJ's place had a sort of White House feel to it, with its pristine white flower boxes and the little leaping concrete fish that flanked the front door. Margot felt like she should be curtsying instead of smacking the trout-shaped door knocker against the aging wood. A handful of unfamiliar cars were parked in the semicircular drive, all with local plates. She could hear people, well, women, inside laughing and talking. It sounded like there were dozens of them. It was oddly soothing. The sounds of a party. Like slipping into old, comfortable slippers. She stopped and smiled. Her hands itched for a clipboard and her earpiece. Her brain switched into full party mode, timing food platters and composing a pleasant toast in her head. She could almost feel the tray of empty champagne flutes in her hand. She had to get a real job soon. No one had answered her knock. Surely, even in the South, even when you were related to your nearest neighbors, it was rude to just walk into someone's house without permission. Maybe it would be better for her to drop Tootie's Tupperware by her front door and run back to her own cabin. She hadn't spoken directly to Tootie since the argument in her car. She didn't want to cause a scene if her great aunt had guests. What if this was a private family thing? She didn't want to interrupt that. Sure, it didn't make sense that they would have a party without inviting her when they'd insistently included her in every remotely interesting moment since she'd arrived. But because her family had been so welcoming, aside from Stan, she didn't want to intrude on the few things they'd kept for themselves. Dropping the containers gently on the porch swing, Margot tiptoed toward the steps.
Margot, honey, where are you heading?
Margot froze and turned to find EJJ standing in the doorway, frowning at her. So much for a graceful exit.
Hi, she said. I was just dropping off Tootie's containers. I knocked, but no one answered.
Aw, honey, you don't have to knock. You're family. You just come on in.
I'm really not comfortable with that, Margot said, shaking her head.
Well, you might as well come in. Tootie's card night just started up. You're going to want to get some food before it gets in full swing.
Oh, I don't want to interrupt.
Sweetheart, I understand that you're trying to use your best company manners, but it doesn't feel polite. It feels like you're keeping us at a distance. I'm not saying let us run roughshod all over you. I've only known you for a short while, and I know that's not your nature. You need to relax just a little bit.
I'm relaxed.
Right now, you're wearing your shoulders as earrings,
EJJ noted. Margot glanced at her shoulders, which were indeed tensed up around her ears. She frowned and forced them down into a slightly less intense posture.
There you go.
Has anyone ever told you that this level of insight is annoying, even in an adorable old man? EJJ grinned, his impossibly white false teeth winking in the dying afternoon light.
Your grandpa would have gotten such a kick out of you. Now go on in there. I'm heading to Bob and Leslie's cabin where it's safe.
That doesn't give me a lot of confidence about going inside, Margot told him.
though she let him shove her inside the door. You are surprisingly strong for an old guy. The voices got even louder as she got closer to the kitchen. Margot had expected the house to be decorated in kitschy Americana and reproduction antiques, but it was subtly done in creamy whites and slate blue. A comfortable rocker stood by a riverstone fireplace. A blue and white quilt was thrown over an overstuffed navy couch. The hardwood floors were painstakingly restored and polished. It wasn't magazine perfect, but it was cozy and clean. Margot's eyes caught on her mother's face, staring out at her from a framed family portrait on the mantel. She stepped closer. The photo was taken in the mid-80s, judging by the hair. The family was mostly recognizable as the one she'd just met. Donna was smiling sweetly, tucked into the side of a big burly man with Duffy's eyes. Tootie was sitting next to EJJ, who had his arm wrapped around her, pulling her close to him. And Linda stood out like a sore blonde thumb, her body angled away from Stan and Margot. Linda stared straight into the camera, her dark eyes flat and bored. Her face was unlined but unsmiling. Margot had always thought her mother had grown into her unhappiness as she got older, but it seemed to be a lifelong trait. How could someone smiling as easily as Stan seemed to be want to make a life with someone so dour? How could the other MacReadies see this photo and not notice how dissatisfied she was? Stan, on the other hand, looked pretty pleased with his life. He was grinning at the little girl in his arms, the toddler with golden curls who had her hands pressed against his sunburned cheeks. In fact, everybody but her mother looked perfectly content. Every other photo in the room was up to date. Why had Tootie held on to this old one, displaying it in such a central location? Given Margot's age, this may have been the last family photo taken before Linda ran off. Was Tootie passive-aggressively trying to remind Stan of the family he'd given up?
"Hey, sweetie! What you doing in there?" Tootie called from the kitchen.
She was dressed in a purple velour tracksuit, but she was wearing a green poker visor on her head and shuffling a deck of cards between her hands like a street magician, which was different. Margot cleared her throat.
"Hi, Tootie. I brought the Tupperware back. Thanks again for the casseroles."
"Well, we have to keep you fed, don't we?"
Tootie motioned her closer with both hands.
"Come on in and meet the girls."
"Oh, I don't want to impose," she said, shaking her head.
"Come on."
Tootie dashed forward and looped her arm through Margot's, practically dragging her past the enormous dining room and into the kitchen. The woman was awfully spry for a senior citizen. Instead of the dozen women Margot expected, there were only three ladies sitting around the kitchen table, cackling and chatting. Aunt Leslie sat at the breakfast bar of Tootie's rooster-themed kitchen, slicing cornbread in a blackened cast-iron pan. At the sound of Tootie's shuffling steps, the ladies' heads snapped up in unison, like blue-haired velociraptors. Tootie gestured to the barstool next to Leslie, and Margot climbed on. Arlo sat at her feet, gently pawing at her stool and looking up with hopeful eyes. She shook her head and scratched behind his ears. She was just happy to see him somewhere besides her porch.
"Girls, this is Stan's girl, Margot," Tootie cooed, giving Margot's hand a squeeze. "Margot, this is Lucille Bodine, Betsy Grandy, and Delilah Dawkins."
Margot smiled. She didn't curtsy, but it was a near thing. She watched as the three women, each sporting football helmet-shaped coiffures and floral print dresses, scanned her from head to toe. Lucille, who had a little dashboard statue of Jesus standing guard in front of her chair, eyeballed Margot with a wary expression. There was audible sniffing. That didn't bode well.
"It's very nice to meet you all," Margot said.
Betsy's red-painted mouth popped open.
Well, don't you sound fancy? Do you work on the TV?
No, scolded Delilah, a reed-thin woman with cow-print reading glasses perched on the end of her nose.
Remember Stan brought her into work for the family business?
Oh, actually, Tootie brought me in to work for the family business, Margot said, while Tootie waved a pig in a blanket in recognition. She's quite the online recruiter. Margot didn't mention that the position was only temporary. Somehow she thought it would embarrass Tootie, and she didn't want to do that in front of her card friends.
Leslie, you didn't put sugar in the cornbread, did you?
Tootie asked.
One little teaspoon doesn't hurt anything, Tootie, Leslie said.
You put sugar in it, it's cake, not cornbread, Tootie said.
Well, when you make the cornbread, you can use your recipe. Otherwise, feel free not to burden yourself by eating my cake, Leslie shot back.
What are you playing? Margot asked in an attempt at a subject change.
Bridge?
Canasta?
Texas Hold'em. Joke is wild. Minimum bet $20,
Tootie said, spreading the cards in a broad fan across the table before sliding them back into her hand and shuffling them with speed unexpected in her arthritic hands. Delilah hauled a casino-style rack of poker chips out of her enormous shoulder bag and plopped it in the middle of the table. Lucille took a roll of bills out of her own handbag and counted out more than $100 in twenties.
I did not see that coming,
Margot said, as Arlo shoved his head insistently against her palm.
You want to play a hand, honey?
Tootie offered, to almost immediate objections from the other players.
It's bad luck to switch players, Lucille protested.
Betsy cried,
You have to give us a chance to win our money back.
Is this some sort of hustle situation? Delilah asked.
I don't think I'm at your level of play, Margot said, raising her hands. I'll just sit over here, where it's safe.
Down, Arlo, Tootie called as he pawed at Margot's legs,
his little doggy expression still hopeful as he sniffed the air. Margot took a tiny piece of cornbread and held it out for him. Arlo snarfed it up, licking at her hand. She wasn't sure whether it was a gesture of canine gratitude or he was searching for crumbs. Leslie slid a plate full of sliced fruit and a bottle of water toward her.
Thank you, Margot sighed, spearing an apple slice with a fork, and gagged the moment she put it to her tongue.
Did you roll the fruit in sugar? Margot asked.
Well, yeah. What sort of flavor would you have without sugar?
Leslie scoffed.
Fruit?
Margot guessed.
Speaking of the food carnival, Tootie said,
none too subtly.
Lucille here says she heard you were talking to Kyle Archer in the beauty section the other day.
Margot narrowly avoided doing a spit take with the water she was using to rinse her teeth of the fruit sugar. She dabbed delicately at her lips with a poker-themed party napkin.
Where did you hear that?
Why would you hear that?
The whole town has been keeping an eye on poor Kyle ever since his wife passed.
Lucille sniffed, again with the sniffing. Wait. Passed? As in passed away? Margot said, an unpleasant cold feeling fluttering through her belly. She'd assumed Kyle was divorced, that his girls struggled because their mother had left them behind when she blew out of this backwater. It had never occurred to Margot that she'd had no choice in the matter. An uncomfortable pressure bloomed around her heart, making her chest ache. Tootie nodded as she dealt the hands.
About 5 years ago, the sweet little thing was just ate up with cancer. She was carrying the youngest at the time, little Juniper. Maggie's mama, Rosie, she said Maggie and Kyle had been trying for another baby for months with no luck. But all of a sudden, she was tired all the time and sick. They thought it was just the usual morning sickness, but the doctor did all the blood work that you do on pregnant women, and They found something off with the cell counts. Breast cancer. Can you believe that? She was 28 years old, having a baby and dying of breast cancer. It had already spread up in her lymph nodes by the time they caught it. And she had the choice between chemo or keeping the baby safe. And she chose the baby. They started her on the treatments as soon as they could after the delivery, but it was too late. She passed when Juniper was only a few months old, bless her heart, leaving Kyle behind with those poor babies. It was one of the saddest services EJJ has ever presided over. And after all these years, his heart is pretty hard to touch. He's not over her, Delilah said. He was still wearing his wedding ring when I saw him at the church picnic last month. Margot pursed her lips. Well, that explained the misery. Was that how Kyle spent his time away from his children? Wandering around town, mourning his lost wife? But if he was still in so much turmoil over her, what was he doing kissing Margot until her insides went to jelly?
I've never cared for him, Betsy said, peering over her reading glasses at her cards.
Delilah shushed her.
What? He's lived in town a few years, but he's hired on as the principal? Jimmy Greenway's barely out of the door, and all of a sudden he's making all sorts of changes at the school?
Kyle Archer was overqualified to teach in the first place, and we were lucky to get him. Jimmy hasn't quite managed to get out the door, if you'll recall, Tootie said. And some of those changes he had to make because the state was going to slap some sort of sanction on the school. Kyle has every right to run the school as he sees fit. He's got all those degrees for a reason.
Fancy degrees from some highfalutin school telling him every kid has to be wrapped in cotton wool and tricked into learning, Betsy said with a snort. Whatever happened to reading, writing, and arithmetic?
Leslie leaned close enough to whisper.
Betsy is Jimmy Greenway's cousin by marriage. She's loyal to a fault.
When she was sure Betsy wasn't listening, she added,
That fault is willful blindness to the fact that Jimmy is a jackass.
Margot bit her lip to contain the laugh that bubbled up.
He's a good man. We want to make sure that if he starts seeing someone, it's the right someone. Not a stranger who hasn't bothered showing up to a church service since she rolled into town. Not some big city girl who's gonna up and leave without a word, Lucille sniped.
Tootie shot her the nice southern old lady version of side-eye, and then announced that she'd just beaten Lucille's flush and taken a lot of her money. Feeling somewhat vindicated by Tootie's strategic support, Margot offered Lucille a frosty smile.
I'm not seeing him. I had a conversation with him in a grocery store. Is there some city ordinance stating that I'm only allowed to speak to an unmarried man if I have a chaperone?
Strong words from someone who had done a lot more than have a conversation with Kyle. In public. Also, how many church services could she have missed so far? She'd only been there a week.
I'm just saying that there's a couple of real nice girls around here who have set their caps for him. And if he's gonna end up with anybody, it's probably gonna be one of them.
Margot tilted her head. Are you telling me there's a dibs system? Lucille opened her mouth to answer, but Betsy demanded,
Are y'all gonna flap your lips or are we gonna play cards? Mamma needs a new pair of shoes.
Fine, fine, Lucille huffed, muttering under her breath, just like her mama.
Margot was prepared to ignore this statement entirely, but Tootie shuffled her cards around in her hands.
Now, Lucille, how is that son of yours? Is he getting along okay with his new parole officer?
Margot watched Lucille's righteous indignation deflate just a little bit.
He likes her just fine. And your grandson?
Tootie asked casually.
Has he paid back Wally Simpson the money he owes for peeing in the drinks cooler at the Gas and Go?
Just about, Lucille mumbled. Margot watched this interaction with horrified fascination. She'd seen this sort of viciously passive reestablishing of pack order in high society circles, but she expected better from members of the Church Floral Guild. Somehow, she thought they'd have a carefully cross-stitched sampler reminding them to behave better. She felt a little bad for Lucille, for being embarrassed in front of her friends. But Lucille had basically told her that she wasn't good enough for Kyle, and besmirched her dead mother. So, don't take it personal, Leslie told her. Lucille's had her eye on young Kyle for her granddaughter Darlene. Does Darlene feel that way about Kyle? No. Lucille just wants Darlene to move out of what was supposed to be her guest room, she said. If you're sparking on Kyle and he's sparking on you, I think y'all would do well together. Sparking? You know, when you look at somebody and you just spark with them. Every time you see them, you get flustered. Every conversation leaves y'all breathless and stupid. Your skin feels too tight and your chest aches.
I think what you're describing is a heart attack, Margot told her. And there's the Stan in you, remorseless smartasses, the both of you. In particular, when you're uncomfortable and trying to change the subject. Leslie snickered. You'll know sparking when you feel it. I had it with my Bob, Lord knows. The man could take me from giddy to spitting tacks and back again in a few seconds. But I wouldn't trade those years for anything.
I don't think I have to worry about sparking anybody. I'm not going to be here long enough to spark. And if I did, I think I would try for something a little less complicated than a widower with two small children.
Complicated can be good, too, Leslie said absently,
and then suddenly grinned when Tootie won another big pot. Leslie pulled out a little notebook and scribbled Tootie's winnings amid several carefully organized columns of numbers.
What's that? Margot asked. Tootie's bet book, Leslie whispered. I keep track of her winnings and debts, so she doesn't lose sight of how much she's gambling.
The pots are a bit richer than I expected, Margot murmured. I thought nice little church ladies played for matches or pennies.
Oh, no. Tootie hasn't played small since the kids moved out and her pin money got more plentiful, Leslie said.
She's been saving up to take EJJ on a fancy cruise to Aruba for nigh on 10 years now. Of course, step one would be getting him to retire, which will take an act of God and Congress.
I thought EJJ made a pretty good living at the funeral home, Margot said. It's a recession-proof business.
Of course he does, Leslie said. But Tootie wants to pay for the cruise with her own money. And that means her poker winnings. Don't let her fool you. She's a card shark.
How close is she?
Close enough that she might kick us out for talking and splitting her attention in a couple of minutes, Leslie said. She's got enough saved for a concierge room for a week-long cruise. Now she just wants to make enough to cover the spa treatments. She's hoping that once she finally gets EJJ on that cruise ship, he'll finally retire. I keep trying to tell her that MacReady men don't retire. They just keep working so long that they eventually fall into the newest grave they dug. But she's holding out hope.
That is very dark, Aunt Leslie, Margot said, picking at her plate.
Can't shine up the truth.
Margot blanched, tossing aside a carrot stick which had been rolled in butter substitute.
I think I'm done.
Monday morning began with Bob and Margot pulling into the MacReady's parking lot and finding Frankie loading embalming equipment into the funeral home van. Margot cast a sidelong glance at Bob, who didn't seem at all alarmed that his daughter was absconding with thousands of dollars worth of sterilized stainless steel. Of course, Bob seemed to be ignoring the fact that their upselling argument had ever happened, so Bob was clearly pretty open to denial. Margot hopped out of the truck, shuddering as her suit jacket seemed to vacuum seal around her body with the force of the humidity. It was a rare cloudy day on the lake, the water gunmetal gray and flat as a dime. Leslie called out from the snack shack, and Bob raised both hands to wave at her. Shaking